Quiet, please.
Ladies and gentlemen.
You ready for the big show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Look, if you hate cops just because they're cops, the next time you get in trouble, call it crackhead.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
I may be a white boy, but I'm not stupid.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
Then we're going to kick the Biden crime family out of the White House.
Here's your host.
My memory is so bad I let you speak.
Lars Larson. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show, and welcome to Monday on the Radio Northwest Network. There is something going on in Oregon's governor's race, governor's office, and that is Tina Kotek and her wife, Amy Kotek Wilson, have been abusing that office, using it for their own personal purposes. And I wanted to start with our visit with D.A. Josh Markey, former district attorney of Clatsop County. Josh, I want to start with this. It's very simple. Is what the governor is doing and allowing her spouse to do, does it rise to the level of criminal misconduct?
It very well might. There's a crime called official misconduct in the first degree, where someone who holds political office or someone is in a government office uses that either to deny someone else an advantage or give themselves one. And it's perfectly acceptable for a first lady or first gentleman or, I suppose, girlfriend of the governor, as it was the case with Kitzhaber, to volunteer to be engaged in something. It's entirely different for state, basically public taxpayer resources to be diverted to staff. And now it's becoming clear that the spouse, the wife of the governor, has been engaging in a series of high-level meetings that she's completely unqualified to be involved with, including the corrections division. She was a fairly low-grade social worker, and on top of which, she has self-disclosed that she's either a recovering addict or substance, and some sort of alcohol or substance abuse problem, which one could say, oh, that's admirable. But, you know, this does not qualify her. And it, and beyond the qualifications, she could volunteer for anything she wants, but it's taxpayer money being spent. And I think that implicates possible criminal charges.
You've actually suggested there should be a formal criminal investigation. Is that right?
There should be, and in this case, it should be undertaken by the Marion County District Attorney's Office. For one reason, in Oregon, all the criminal authority devolves to the district attorney, not the attorney general, in addition to which this particular attorney general would probably ignore anything bad that Kotek or her wife did. And secondly, it's just the right place to do it. Now, whether or not Paige Clarkson, who is the district attorney, will do anything about it will be left to be seen. But if they don't, I mean, if a prosecutor doesn't choose to begin an investigation, there will be no criminal charges. The other option, obviously, is the Oregon Government Ethics Commission, which might be the most toothless organization ever invented.
And in fact, they would do next to nothing. I mean, I know they fined Kitzhaber and his gal pal, this grifter Sylvia Hayes, they fined him some tens of thousands of dollars. But Sylvia Hayes got a couple of hundred grand. And frankly, Josh, I'm not of a criminal inclination, but if you told me, Lars, you can make $200,000 if you want to break the law, and you only have to pay 50 in a fine, I'd say the math on that seems to work out really well, Josh.
Again, we elect governors, we elect state legislators. We don't elect their spouses or their boyfriends or girlfriends or family members. Now, the exception that a lot of people make a mistake is with the Oregon legislature. The legislators are paid essentially a part-time wage, about $29,000 to $35,000 a year. And so there's been a historic allowance to allow legislators to hire family members. And it happens in both the Democratic and Republican Party. It's not unusual. That's different than the executive of the state. Or, for example, when I was district attorney, my wife is a very skilled editor, but if I had decided that she should be paid $20,000 a year to put out a newsletter, I think I could have been indicted.
Yeah, and let me ask you about this, because there's another abuse of this office that apparently is being committed by Amy Kotek Wilson, the wife, in this case, the mentally ill alcoholic wife, and I'll get to that in a moment about her alcoholism. But she apparently had one of her friends from Cascadia Behavioral Health, which is a nonprofit that does mental health.
A giant nonprofit that does huge amounts of business.
And they get a lot of money from the state. And, Josh, I'd be lying if I didn't tell you there are people who call me and say, hey, Lars, call so-and-so. I've got a beef with him, and I want you to tell him you're looking into it. And I say, no, I'm not doing it unless I truly am looking into something. And I have people who ask me to do that. And I say, no, I'm not going to do that, even though it probably would be nothing illegal for me to do it. But when the governor goes to her staff and says, hey, one of Amy's friends is having a problem with her supervisor. This actually happened at Cascadia Behavioral Health. Get on the phone and call them and say it's the governor's office and we're calling about this issue involving a supervisor and an employee. How do you describe that kind of throwing your weight around?
Well, people may not remember this. I was elected 7 times as district attorney. The reason I got my job originally was that the previous district attorney got mad because her boyfriend got pulled over by the cops, and she called up the chief of police, chief of police of Astoria, and said she wanted consideration. She wasn't really explicit, but she clearly wanted it. That ended up resulting in her indictment, recall, conviction, and jailing. Now, I'm not saying it's exactly the same, but Oregon has always prided itself on having, if often dysfunctional politics, at least clean ones. But you know, the one thing that I think particularly people on the right who may not have any particular affection for Kotek, I can't say that I do.
I don't.
I'm not sure she's worth that. But aside from that, just look at what's going on. I think it was either yesterday or maybe this weekend, her director of communications abruptly quit. Fourth major person to essentially walk off the job. Now, we have no idea what the backstory on this, other than these are people who've had a long-term allegiance to Tina Kotek, who was the very powerful Speaker of the House for many years, and are apparently so appalled by what she's doing that they're willing to walk away from government employment.
Last issue, Josh. I wish my dad had kicked alcohol. He never did. But every alcoholic I've ever met is usually, if they're in recovery, and they always say, once you're an alcoholic, you're always... always tell you, I've been clean and sober for, and then some of them will give it down to days. You know, 11 years, 3 months, and 12 days.
Sure.
We're not hearing that about Amy Kotek, Amy Kotek Wilson. So
it makes me believe that
she's still an alcoholic, an active alcoholic.
Well, she's always going to be an alcoholic. But the question is, how does that qualify her to make policy decisions for the state of Oregon?
But the other problem is, I think Tina Kotek is using the taxpayers' resources to effectively babysit her mentally ill and alcoholic spouse, and that's absolutely wrong. Josh, thanks very much.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Thinking of selling your
right on the left coast. Get it? Here's Lars Larson. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you. And in all honesty, I'm not a gigantic sports fan. I'm not against them either. I think sports is perfectly fine for people who find that very interesting. I've never liked, and I've always opposed, the idea of public subsidies for sports facilities. You know, when we subsidize some things and we don't subsidize other things. So when I saw that the Taxpayers Association of Oregon had actually come out and pointed out that in the city of Eugene and Lane County, they are asking for a gigantic increase, $15 million in new property taxes to support a gigantic overhaul of the baseball stadium, the Emeralds baseball stadium, and that it made no sense, and that apparently the people behind that effort are now using the argument, well, if we have wildfires during a given summer, which Oregon these days seems to have just about every summer because of bad forest management, we'll be able to put tents up all over the baseball field and house people there, which is a cockamamie idea. But David Lovell joins me now. He's a county commissioner in Lane County, and David called in serendipitously. So, Commissioner, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Lars. We love you down here in the Southern Willamette Valley.
Well, thank you for that. Do you favor giving a subsidy to this baseball stadium? Let's just start with the basics there.
My basic answer is no. As a developer before I was elected, I think this is one of the worst real estate deals I've seen in my career.
Why are they doing it then? Why cave in? And I understand everybody's proud of the M's. It's great to have a local baseball team. That's all good. But how do they justify the idea of soaking the taxpayers for, you know, $15 million and then saying, oh, but by the way, we can use the baseball field as a refuge in case of wildfires?
Well, this is one of those typical deals, Lars, where emotion drives the narrative. And in real estate, emotion always loses money. $15 million is not even basically 10% of the total cost of the stadium. It's an entirely rebuilt county property, which is the Lane Event Center in downtown Eugene. That's the idea. And I event like an ice storm that we had. Can you imagine an ice storm sheltering people in an open baseball field when it's 18 degrees outside? The idea is preposterous.
Well, and not only that, David, but if you're building it as a baseball stadium, and I thought the suggestion, and the first thing I'd think of if you said we need to shelter a huge number of people on short notice in any community in America, the first thing I'd think of is public schools. And why? Because they have large spaces inside, not just classrooms, but gymnasiums and auditoriums and such. They have cafeteria facilities and usually kitchens. They have bathrooms. And in the case of middle schools and high schools, they usually have bathrooms and locker rooms and showers and facilities like that. They have all the facilities, and if you need to pitch a bunch of tents, if the weather is accommodating, you usually have large stretches of green grass outside elementary schools, except you already own those. And in the summertime, which is when the wildfires most commonly start, the schools are generally not in use, but baseball fields are. Who is it that thinks this is a sensible idea? Give us their name so that we can, which county commissioners like this idea, and we'll invite them on the show to try to explain it.
Well, I don't want to give up the ship. I'm not sure this idea will float. The M's, like you said, have been a 70-year great partner in the community. There's no doubt about that. I just think that, like I said before, the emotion of trying to make emotional pitches toward the stadium build is what's driving it. The schools, like you said, are a great idea. We're now developing partnerships with the schools as we speak to do exactly what you've described, which I think is a better idea, to use infrastructure already forking out a lot of money. If Eugene even does vote this in my opinion, to build the stadium. The reason that the current property was considered is because, like I said, it was county-owned, and it was the cheapest option for the baseball league to pressure the M's to make a quick decision.
Now, I've got another idea, David, and I very rarely see people even try this. But about a decade ago, somebody was pitching a lesser baseball team than the M's, but still one that was, you know, had paid attendance and all that. And I said, why are the taxpayers subsidizing this? And I was talking to a guy who's pro sports and not professional sports, but he was in favor of it. And he said, well, you know, if the taxpayers don't subsidize, it'll stop existing. I said, well, isn't that okay? I mean, if you don't have enough supporters, but when we worked through the numbers, you know, we took how long is this facility going to last? I don't know, 30 years. How many people go to a ball game every, you know, how many ball games are there in a given year? We worked it out, and it would have meant maybe $5 or $6 more on every ticket. And he said, well, but tickets are now, back then, $9. He said, that'd be a $15 ticket. I said, yeah. So in other words, a father and son or mother and daughter could go to a baseball game for $30. What would it cost them to go to a movie? You know, and those are for profit and not subsidized. You say, well, that would cost them about $30. I say, well, what's wrong with having the people who enjoy the activity actually pay the real cost of providing the activity? Has anybody on the county commission considered that?
No, well, I'm sure the county commission, we have considered that. I think the, like I said, the basic citizens are so attached emotionally to hanging on to something, and they're, in their mind, they're saying that this is still a family-friendly event, when in fact you just described the costs increase every year, and attendance sometimes will not pay for the cost. In the developer world, it's got to pencil out. And anytime you have a government agency partnering with public, typically the taxpayer doesn't get the pencil out benefits of that.
Well, and David, back when I lived, I've lived in Lane County a couple of times. I used to go with one of our engineers up, go skiing on the weekend. I was a nice guy, and we, you know, we both liked skiing, and we were single. And so, and lift tickets aren't cheap either. But the, but it has to pencil out. If you say, well, gosh, if the taxpayers don't subsidize lift tickets, people won't be able to go skiing. I think most people would say, well, tough for them. You know, I mean, you want to do the activity, pay the cost. And you want the taxpayers who don't go to baseball games to pay to supply the baseball games so you can go to them. You know, they run that argument on ballet. They run it on opera. They run it on the symphony. They run it on a bunch of stuff. I say make it all pay for itself. And if you tell me, well, there aren't enough people who like doing that activity to make it pencil out, you say, well, then it'll probably go away. There are lots of things we don't do in America because, you know, I mean, cricket. you don't have any cricket fields either. But Great Britain has them all over the place. Make them pay for themselves.
Exactly. Lars, you sound like one of those crazy capitalists who think that the government should run stuff like a business, which I totally agree, which is funny because a lot of people come to me and say, Commissioner, what I'd like is for us to have this family activity in our community, which makes our life better, but don't want to pay for it, but yet they expect the government to pay for it when they're somehow not contributing to the government coffers. I'm not sure how they pencil that out in their heads.
I mean, I'm trying to imagine, Tina and I used to own a boat at one point. We don't own a boat now, but I'm trying to imagine if I went door to door in my neighborhood, knocked on the door, say, hey, we're going to go down on the boat this weekend, but, you know, gas is like $7 a gallon for the boat. Would you guys be willing to chip in? You're not invited to come with us, but we'd like you to pay for the cost of the gas so we can go boating this weekend. I'm pretty sure that wouldn't go over well with my neighbors.
I would suspect you wouldn't be the most popular neighbor in my neighborhood, Lars.
That or they just laugh at me and slam the door in my face. David, thank you very much.
Yeah, you're awesome. Thanks again, Lars.
Thank you, sir. That is Lane County Commissioner David Lovell talking about the baseball field that they're trying to talk the taxpayers into putting up $15 million to help as part of a $90 million rebuild of a baseball stadium, because they said if we just depended on the people who go to the baseball games, why, it would never pencil out. Well, if that's the case, so be it. Sorry. It's First Amendment Friday. Your calls are welcome at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show. The Lars Larson Show. Spotify, Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Google. Yeah, he's everywhere. The Lars Larson Podcast. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm always glad to get to your calls, and I'll do that in a moment at 866-HEY-LARS. I got no dog in the fight on TikTok. I don't use TikTok. I don't like the idea of a Chinese communist spy app being resident on any of the devices that I use, pads or computers or anything else. And it's not that I dislike TikTok. I dislike the fact that it's owned by the Chinese communist government, which can use it and will use it as a data gathering device inside the United States. So I wasn't entirely unhappy when the House of Representatives voted on Saturday and they said yes by a margin of 360-58. So that's a lot of Democrats and a lot of Republicans all saying, look, we don't want TikTok to be in the United States as long as it's owned by a company that's controlled by the Chinese Communist government. So I knew I had to call our friend Weifeng Zhang, who's senior advisor for the Office of Fiscal and Regulatory Analysis at the America First Policy Institute and an affiliated scholar at the Mercatus Center. Dr. Zhang, welcome back.
Thank you for having me back, Laura.
Is this going to pass the Senate by your read of how things are going? I realize that's a political question instead of a China or a technology question, but do you think if the House got on board with that big a bipartisan vote, is the Senate going to say yes as well?
I think it's quite, very likely at this point. I think the sentiment in this town in Washington against TikTok is probably as high as it has ever been. But of course, the president still has to sign it. At a policy level, I think I agree with every word you said, Lars, and we have talked about this, the problem with TikTok several times before. It is it creates a significant security issue for the information space we live in, right? Because it's a hugely popular app, but everybody who's on it, their information is collected by the company, which then could potentially be passed on to Beijing, and that creates a lot of problem for the national security of the United States. So I think it's definitely a problem, and it would be a good move if we can get rid of this problem associated with the app. But I mean, the problem China brings is much broader, right? And even if they couldn't spy on us on TikTok, they are still spying on us in many other different ways. And so I think we have a long way to go in terms of addressing all these issues.
You know, I think you're right about that. Yes, they can spy on us other ways, but let's not make it easy for them. The other thing is, when people say, well, you'll get rid of TikTok in America, Dr. Zhang, shouldn't I expect that if ByteDance, the owner of TikTok, which does not allow American TikTok to be in front of Chinese eyes in China, they don't allow it there. They have a different version that's just completely different, not language, but in everything else, content and everything else. So if they don't want it, if they don't want their own population exposed to it, but if they were faced with you can't operate this as a Chinese company in America anymore, which is not any different than the rules that foreign nationals can't own more than a small percentage of American television and radio. And there's a reason for that limitation. Wouldn't they simply spin the company off and make an American, allow the American part of TikTok to be owned by a company outside of communist China?
Well, I think the problem is it not only has to be outside of the communist China, it has to be because currently the company is not state-owned, right? But its parent company is state-owned. So we have to fundamentally cut this connection off. And I think there's a fundamental distinction. We talk about big techs all the time. In you know, a lot of social media companies in the U.S., they collect user information too. But they don't have to listen to the CCP, right? Nope. TikTok has to. So there's a fundamental difference there that we need to address.
Well, and I even think there's an issue for American companies, whether it's Meta or Facebook, whether it's Twitter or X, that if the government comes to them and wants data, that typically, I know they've misbehaved before, but they say, well, show us your warrant. If you want a bunch of data on our users, show us the warrant. Otherwise, you have no right to it. But the relationship between the United States government and social media companies and the relationship between Chinese companies and the Chinese communist government is as different as night and day, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, I mean, we have a lot of double standards when it comes to our relations with China. We don't address problems posed by Chinese companies the same way we address it. By U.S. company, China doesn't allow American apps to go into China either. Right? You mentioned the American TikTok, but China doesn't allow Google, doesn't allow Facebook, and any place where we have freedom, all these platforms, they're not carried by China. Because I think China fundamentally realized that we are a free society, and that makes them embarrassed. They embarrass the Communist Party.
I can get on the anniversary of Tiananmen Square and write a big essay and talk about how evil it was and how the evil continues today with social media, social scores and the rest of that. China isn't going to allow my commentary to show up in front of its citizens, is it?
Well, not at all. It means that you are saying the right things, Lars. But the other side of that coin is that oftentimes, we don't want TikTok to be popular in the U.S., not just because they collect information, because the other side is that once enough Americans are on this platform, which currently is the case, then TikTok could potentially have an opportunity to sway American voters, American people, in their decisions, they even asked them to call your congressman to not ban us, right? So they could have said, they could be saying the same thing in the election year as well.
Well, and there are other examples that go outside of that where China will give money to NGOs, the NGOs give it to environmental groups, and the environmental groups say, hey, we had to change over to battery-powered cars, and they push that as a public policy. Now, who makes the batteries for the cars? China makes the batteries. And if China pushes an environmental message to Americans through other means and says, you really ought to have rooftop solar bought in China, you really ought to have windmills made in China, you ought to have battery cars made in China, or at least the batteries are now, and they're planning a plant in Mexico. All of those are gigantic, what, multi-trillion dollar decisions for Americans, and we could have Americans influenced in what we want or don't want based on what China feeds us through TikTok.
Well, yeah, exactly. That's the problem we have been having since China, ever since China joined the WTO, because China is and was and still able to produce a lot of products at a very low cost. And that led to a lot of the stuff we have in our day-to-day life being made in China. Now, not all of them are problematic, but sometimes they are, right? We have all these tech products that could potentially spy on the American people. But even with very cheap goods you can see on the shelves on, say, at Walmart, some of them are made with forced labor, and that is not something we can tolerate with our moral values, too. So there's the consequence of this, I would say, careless but romantic, maybe overly romantic engagement.
I mean, look at this. We've got college kids right now protesting in favor of a terrorist group that slaughtered, 1,200 people less than 6 months ago. And you say, well, how would you ever get all those kids to do that? Well, if you got 170 million TikTok users in America, and China wants to push the point of view that reunifying, as they call it, with a country they've never been unified with before, Taiwan, they make it sound very popular to do that and just let China solve its own domestic problems and have the U.S. stay out. They could easily push that point of view. Dr. Weifeng Zhang is Senior Advisor for the Office of Fiscal and Regulatory Analysis at America First. He's affiliated with the Mercatus Center. Dr. Zhang, it's always a pleasure to have you on the program. Glad to get to your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@larslarson.com. Naysayers always go to the head of the line on this show, and you can vote in our poll on X. You'll find that at Lars Larson Show. And you're listening to the Radio Northwest Network.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show. Political climate. He's the steamroller. This is the Lars Larson Show. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Monday. And you know what's going on right now? We've got Title IX being rewritten. Now, Title IX was created originally to allow women and girls an equal opportunity, especially when it comes to sports in both public schools and in universities and colleges. And what's happening now? Joe Biden, without going to the Congress, is saying we're going to rewrite Title IX to say that it's whatever gender that you identify with, not necessarily your born gender, and that this is going to be forced on the states. And already we're hearing a number of states that are saying we're not going to do it. And so you're seeing a real split between the federal government and the governments of the states. So Ian Pryor joins me now, who's senior advisor with America First Legal. Ian, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Is this the way that we're going to have to see this go down, that Joe Biden illegally or unconstitutionally rewrites a bunch of bureaucratic rules and then says we're going to force these on the states, and the states' only choice in this case, at least for the immediate future, is to simply say we're going to ignore the rules?
Well, that's certainly one way to do it, and the other way to do it is as we've done it, representing the state of Texas, suing the federal government for their vast overreach here in implementing this rule that changes the definition of sex way beyond what Congress could have contemplated in 1972 when they enacted Title IX. But this has really been something that's been on the horizon for years, ever since the Obama administration. You know, they tried to do this with a variety of guidance documents. Those guidance documents were either stopped by courts or they were revoked in the Trump administration. But, you know, Biden is clearly looking to, you know, enact this insane regulatory agenda that, as you said, I mean, this is not something that is going to protect women. This is, you know, it is quackery. I mean, if there's one word to describe it, it's quackery. You know, biological sex is biological sex. It's ironic that the very same people that 4 years ago were telling everyone to follow the science are now putting rules in place telling you not to follow science.
Well, and in fact, if they thought this had the support of the American public, which is the way we're supposed to make rules and laws, I understand the need for a bureaucracy. I understand the need to write all the nitty-gritty rules that help implement a law. But if they thought this had the support of the American people, they'd march it up to Capitol Hill and say, let's vote on a bill. Let's change the definition of sex. But Joe Biden hasn't even tried to do that because apparently he knows that even Democrats on Capitol Hill are not going to pass such a bill. Doesn't he?
I think that's absolutely right. Any attempt to legislate this would be dead on arrival. So what they're trying to do with this rule is essentially rewrite legislation, which is not what the executive branch is supposed to do. The executive branch, you know, yes, they can implement rules that put into effect laws as they are written, but that is not what this does. This essentially overturns that law and now mandates that if you are a institution of higher learning or if you're K-12 elementary and you take any amount of federal funds whatsoever, then that means, you know, your girls' bathrooms now get to be opened up to, you know, boys based on their quote unquote gender identity, and they don't even really define what gender identity is. And that if you, you know, refer to somebody by he because, you know, the person is a male, you could be subject to discipline and discrimination proceedings because, you know, you misgendered them when they decide that they want to go by female pronouns. And that's really what this rule does. And it holds these schools and these educational institutions hostage because if you want federal funds, then you have to comply with this.
I mean, Ian, one of the things that's troubling, I'm not a lawyer or anything like that, and I always tell my audience that, but I thought, how can you get at this? If you're a young lady and you're going to either high school or college, and you're forced to use a locker room with a biological male who now identifies as female, your civil rights, your privacy rights, I think, are being violated. And they're creating a hostile environment for you. I haven't heard any stories yet that indicate that some young lady said, look, I was on the tennis team, but I'm not showering with guys, so I'm going to have to quit the team. This is unconscionable. Is there any action that individuals like parents and grandparents could take to say, well, then let's file a civil rights violation? If your school is forcing you to shower with or use a bathroom with a biological male, they're creating a hostile hostile environment. Now, would hostile environment still apply there, even though it's not a workplace?
Well, you know, we actually have a case in Virginia against Fairfax County Public Schools on this issue. It's in state court. It's not in federal court. So we're proceeding under the Virginia Constitution. And, you know, there's two theories to this case. I mean, it involves a young woman at school that didn't feel comfortable using a bathroom in which a biological boy based on some kind of gender identity was using it. And when, you know, she asked the principal, she was said, well, you know, if you want to feel safe and comfortable in the bathroom, you're going to have to use a single-use bathroom. Well, look, that is sex discrimination.
Yes, it is. Ian, thanks for what you're doing at America First Legal, and I appreciate the time. That's Ian Pryor, a senior advisor with America First Legal. Now, if you want to join what we call the best conversation in talk journalism, it's here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. You can send emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. You can vote in our poll on X. And, of course, naysayers always go to the head of the line. If you disagree with yours truly, you are certainly welcome to be put first in line to make a comment, ask a question, demand answers of me, whatever you'd like to do. That's what we call naysayers. We've been affording naysayers that opportunity for more than 25 years.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
The Lars.
Quiet, please.
Ladies and gentlemen.
You ready for the bit, soul?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Look, if you hate cops just because of the cops, the next time you get in trouble, call a crackhead.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
I may be a white boy, but I'm not stupid.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
Then we're going to kick the Biden crime family out of the White House.
Here's your host.
My memory is so bad, I let you speak.
Lars Larson. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Conspiracy Theory Thursday, and this one might stretch your imagination a bit, but I want to throw this one at our friend Dr. Curry Myers, who's a criminologist, former sheriff, and state trooper. Dr. Myers, welcome back to the program.
Always a pleasure, my friend.
I guess I wasn't surprised, Dr. Myers, when I heard that a House committee had actually released a report and said not only is all that fentanyl and the precursor chemicals to make fentanyl, say, in Mexican labs, not only is it coming from China, but it's coming from companies that are owned and controlled by the Chinese Communist Party, the government, and it is being incentivized by tax incentives that are offered up by the Chinese government to these companies. Because, I mean, forgive me for being maybe naive, Dr. Myers, but I guess for the longest time I thought, well, okay, the Chi-Coms run a weird society, and maybe you've got people out there who are running chemical factories, and they're making a little fentanyl on the side to make some extra money. But it sounds like this is actually a Chinese-owned and controlled effort to manufacture the stuff and dump it into the marketplace where they know it's going to come into the United States.
Well, that's exactly correct, Lars. We have to remember that Chinese businesses are the Chinese government. They're not differentiated at all. So whatever the Chinese government wants to do, the Chinese businesses will do it. From economic point of view, the fentanyl trade presents a really lucrative opportunity for China to really capitalize on the opioid crisis. They are involved not only in fentanyl, but xylazine, which is known as Trang. So they're the primary sources of supply for both those. They're imported not only as solids and as liquids. In fact, both of these drugs have any route of administration from the user point of view. That means they can take it anyway to get the high. And they're also overtaking the illicit cannabis market, which a lot of people are unaware of as they move into the United States. But they want to be a key player. From an economic point of view, they can make a lot of money, but from a geopolitical point of view, they can destabilize governments and enemies of them, which America is one of those. So taking advantage of the opioid epidemic and ensuring that they're increasing a vast supply of sourcing material and products that are come through the Mexican drug trafficking routes. So Mexico is not on its own by this. They're joining in a partnership with China. But there's no question that this is a evil alliance that is occurring, and it's to hurt America, it's to hurt Americans, and it's to destabilize us.
You know, it's funny, it kind of reminded me that Lenin is said to have said at one point, we will sell Americans the rope that they will use to hang themselves. And it sounds like the Chinese took a chapter out of that book and said, okay, we're going to destabilize their society. We're going to poison and kill a lot of people, over 100,000 a year with fentanyl, and we're going to make money while we're doing it. And we're going to not just kill people directly with the fentanyl, but we will destabilize their communities because the people who are addicted to it before they end up dying of overdose are going to commit other crimes. They're going to create other kinds of societal problems within America. And they can use this as a tool to weaken America dramatically at the same time that we've had 30,000 of their young fighting age Chinese males just happen to show up on our southern border and come into the United States. And they are God knows where at this point.
Well, that's exactly right. We have had more than 37,000 Chinese citizens that have been apprehended crossing the border illegally just last year alone. That's 50 times more than in the past. Their expertise in evading law enforcement and really navigating the supply chain They're very organized. They're very focused. They understand the illicit market, and they hope to use scale and scope to continue to control the market. This is transnational crime, and it's not just the federal government that now has to worry about transnational crime. Even local law enforcement has to worry about transnational crime. I was talking to a sheriff last night in Northern California. He again says that the amount of people coming into his county that are Chinese to come in and work at labs has increased significantly, and it's continuing to be a problem. So even local law enforcement now has to be experts in transnational crime, because we have not only the Chinese, but we have Eastern European organized crime that is moving in and also trying to control a lot of the drug markets.
And what should we be doing at this point? And I wouldn't mind if you said the things that Joe Biden is not doing at this point, because he's constantly bragging about the amount of time he's spent either flying or talking with Chairman Xi, the head of the Chinese Communist Party. But he doesn't tell us that he's putting any pressure on Xi to stop all this stuff.
Well, you bring back the Trump policies that were in place when he was president. The first and foremost is to make sure that you have certain sanctions in place to bring China to bear. You try to hurt them economically as well, which was done during the Trump age. So that's why they wanted to work closer with us. You have to, my goodness gracious, you have to close the border to ensure that we have total border control. And you have to start back down by ratcheting completely. You have to start really with a closed border and then turn it on as a spigot as you understand the flow that's coming into the country. You have to have prosecution of criminals. We have people who are committing crimes that are getting put back out even after they commit the crimes and arrested by law enforcement, because we have many prosecutors that are very poor, if not corrupt, where they're letting people out on cashless bail, and it's continually to spiral out of control. And as far as the opioid market, we have to understand that really fentanyl and xylazine is a poison. They're using it as a poison. They're not using it as a drug. They are trying to kill Americans, and it's working.
Well, and I guess the proof that this is aimed at us is that this is not an illicit market where they make this stuff and sell it in China and sell it in the United States. The Chinese are apparently able to control it not being sold in their country to make sure that it is sold in our country. And at this point, with a Congress that's unwilling to convict Mayorkas of lying to Congress about the security of the border, with a president who's unwilling to call China on the carpet for this kind of thing, and a president who's unwilling to do anything to control the border, and the Congress won't do it either, Dr. Myers, I think we're in a world of hurt. I appreciate your time, sir. Thanks very much.
Always a pleasure. Stay safe.
Thank you, sir, and you too, you and yours. Dr. Curry Myers is a criminologist, former sheriff, and former state trooper. It's great to be with you on a Conspiracy Theory Thursday. If you want to join the conversation, it's 866-HEY-LARS. Send your emails to me, talk@LarsLarson.com. We've got a little effort that I do on Instagram. You should check that out when you get the chance. You'll find it at The Lars Larson Show on Instagram. You can tell Alexa to play The Lars Larson Show.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show. From President Reagan.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us. We the people are the driver. The government is the car. And we decide where it should go.
This is the Lars Larson Show. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. And it's the Radio North. and there's a crazy plan to start scattering scooters, e-scooters, around the city of Spokane, and whether or not that's going to actually do any good for anybody or not, it'll be cute, I guess, until the vandals start throwing them in the Spokane River or something like that, which tends to happen to yellow bikes and a lot of other things. So I thought we'd check in with our friend Mark Harmsworth, who's the director of the Small Business Center at Washington Policy. Hey, Mark, welcome back.
Thanks for having me on, Lance. I appreciate it.
I gotta wonder about this because in some ways I'm a little more accommodating about things like the free bike idea, you know, with the predictable result that they end up thrown in the river. And that's happened in Portland. I imagine they throw them in Puget Sound and Seattle. And in Portland, they throw them into the Willamette River. And now they've put out all these scooters, or they want to scatter them around the Spokane Valley and other parts of Spokane, which is a place that in the wintertime is not the place I'd want to be riding a scooter. But tell me about what's going on here. Who's doing this? Why? And how much of the public's money is getting wasted?
Well, Lime is the company that's doing this. Kind of like you, Lars, I don't necessarily have anything against these scooters. If you want to ride one, knock yourself out. But when it comes at the expense of the public, that's when I'm going to get more concerned about it. So what Lime is doing is they're deploying e-scooters in Spokane Valley, in Newport, and they also have had programs in Spokane before with the aforementioned scooters that were being thrown at the Spokane River, which caused a huge amount of environmental impact. But the thing that drives me a little bit batty about what the scooter companies do is they talk about this as this great panacea of environmental help, where we're going to get the cars off the roads and we're going to reduce carbon output and all this type of stuff, the feel-good policies. And yet, when you actually look at it holistically, what happens is the scooters don't last as long as they're supposed to. They get placed all over the sidewalks. I mean, Seattle's even banned you wearing or released the regulations on wearing helmets. So you've got some significant safety issues. The impact from being thrown in the river or just tossed aside. Everyone's seen these things in the ditches. And then the impact of the companies having to go clean all this up, pick these things up and charge them up every night to make it work. So it really isn't about commuting or reducing environmental impact. These are fun toys that these companies put into our city centers at the expense of the taxpayers' right of way, which the city has to provide for free.
Yeah, and as far as you know, is Lime taking any money from the government? Because this smells like the kind of thing that would get a big grant from EPA or somebody else.
I don't know specifically because we don't have records in their private companies. We can't see that. But we do see some of the grant money that's being spent by the cities on these companies to bring these scooters in. And the majority of the ride, they tout that they've had 2.5 million rides in the Spokane area over the last couple of years. And they talk about this, but most of it is just downtown fun rides for people driving around town. And, you know, they're fun. The scooters are fun, but they're also dangerous and they cause all these problems as well.
Well, and Mark, my take on it is beyond a toy, I would imagine that some people might find them convenient. If you work in a downtown area, especially, say, a place like Seattle, where there are a lot of hills, Portland doesn't have as many hills, but it can be, you know, you're walking from the Willamette River up. You can have a hill not quite as bad as the Denny Avenue in Seattle or some of those streets. But I would imagine that if you work in a downtown area and you think, I'm going to go up the street and have lunch, you might grab a scooter and ride a few blocks on it as being more convenient than, you know, grabbing your car out of the garage or taking an Uber for a relatively short trip. So it becomes kind of a convenience, but nothing more than that. In other words, the person who would get the scooter is going to say, I'll take a scooter because I'm going 8 blocks down the sidewalk and it's uphill, and I'd rather take the scooter than walk. But that doesn't really save anything because you wouldn't have used a car for that kind of trip anyway.
Yeah, you've just nailed it right on the head there. I think that is the majority of the trips. And when the companies say that they're replacing a car trip, they're really not, because you're going to drive. I mean, who's going to drive to Spokane in the middle of the winter on a scooter to work? I mean, it's ridiculous. So you're going to drive to work, and you might get a scooter to go 2 blocks in your lunch break. Or maybe pick things up, but you can't go shopping on them. You can't do any of this stuff because it's just too dangerous. I mean, these things zip along, as you've seen them, I'm sure. So that's the majority of the trips. So the carbon offset that they talk about is just not there. It's you're replacing walking. And if you look at it from that perspective, suddenly these things become incredibly unenvironmentally friendly because they're being created themselves.
Well, and I got to tell you, the safety issue is not just a safety issue for the person on the scooter. And forgiving the incidents of helmets and all that, it's I remember one time I was working in television news and I was working with a photographer, a good guy, Andy, and we were walking out of a downtown building and he got clobbered by a guy on a bicycle. And I said, well, you're not supposed to be on a bicycle on the sidewalk anyway, but it happened to my photographer, who's a tough guy, so he didn't, he shook it off. But he had a $50,000 TV camera on his shoulder at the time he got clobbered, and thank God that didn't get wrecked. But when you think about what happens, I'm not even sure what the law says about where these scooters are supposed to be. If they're in the street with all the regular traffic, then the scooter rider is at great risk. And if they're on the sidewalk, they're putting all the pedestrians, especially the older ones or the small, younger ones, kids, at risk as well. You've got a, 200-pound guy on a scooter who clobbers your 10-year-old son or daughter. You can do some real damage. And, of course, with cars, you've got to have liability insurance. I'm not sure how that works with scooters.
Yeah, on the sidewalks, incredibly dangerous. And I've had a couple of close shaves with them. I was down in Seattle just last week, and some guy zipped right past me. Looks like he was having a great time doing his carbon offset. But the rest of the time, if you put them on the road there, I mean, you're putting these scooter riders in with large trucks, and they're completely undefended. And they're even more dangerous, I think, than bicycles, because you're typically on a bicycle, you're prepared, it's your machine. With these scooters, you can get on, you can rent one, and you've never ridden a scooter before, and you zip down the sidewalk, and yeah, you're presenting quite a danger both to yourself and to those around you.
Well, and in theory, the bike riders have to at least give hand signals when they're turning. But on a car, you've got to have working turn signals, a working horn, all these other things. On the scooter, none of that is present, and yet they're allowed to share the road and, I guess, the sidewalk at the same time. And are the cities listening to any of those concerns, or are they just saying, hey, this is popular, let's let it happen?
Well, in the case of Seattle, it's the latter. I mean, that's why they relaxed a lot of the helmet laws, because they were saying that you had to have a helmet to get on your little scooter, and who thinks about it when they get up in the morning? I must take my bicycle helmet with me in case I want to ride a scooter during the day. So they relaxed that law. So I think the cities see these as a way of improving their downtown cores, and honestly, all they're doing is creating a whole bunch of litter and danger to pedestrians and to road users at the same time.
And then we have to figure out, and does Lime end up paying the cost when you have to fish 250 scooters out of the Spokane River?
In that case, they didn't. It was local concerned citizens. I remember some of the environmental clubs that went in and removed those scooters. And that was just 1 year. 250 scooters. And you know how heavy these things are. That must have been quite the effort to get them out.
But hey, we listen, have all the never underestimate the efforts of vandals in this day and age, because they know there's no consequence. That's Mark Harmsworth from Washington Policy. Back in a moment.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show. The Lars Larson Show. Just listen for 5 minutes. You'll feel better. More with Lars Larson right now. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails in a moment. And I know a lot of people are hot under the collar about the deal, the sleazy deal that was cut by PSU with the pro-Hamas terrorists who took over a building on the PSU campus for a couple of days. But we'll get to that in just a moment. Nigel Jacobs joins me now, Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter from Willamette Week. You can find his stories at WWeek.com. Hey, Nigel, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Lars.
I want to talk to you about the troubles that the governor of Oregon is having blown up her senior staff and distanced herself from serving citizens with a fight over making her spouse an official part of state government. But before I do that, I will give you the opportunity, if you'd like, to say anything you want to say about this takeover by the pro-Hamas protesters on the PSU campus and the sleazy deal the university tried to cut to say, we'll let you get away with anything, you'll face no consequences, and we'll even do some of the things you're asking us to do. Any comment on that, or should we move right to Amy Kotek Wilson?
I have to confess that I have been so focused on the governor's story that I haven't done anything else, so I am totally ignorant of what's going on. I know there's a takeover at the library. I know nothing beyond that.
Yeah, that happens to me, too. When I'm really focused on a story, there are times I ignore everything else, and I don't blame you. But this story that you've been tracking, and you've really done the yeoman's work on this, about how Governor Tina Kotek has now, well, she's trying to make her spouse an official part of government, not a salaried part yet, but an official part of the state government. And in the process, I think I would say she has blown up her senior staff who've quit apparently in disgust and walked away. And she hasn't been serving the needs of citizens, in my view, because I think she's distracted by her own personal problems. What's the latest we should know about that?
We put a story up late last night. It's in the print edition today that has what I think is an email that really gets to the heart of what's going on. And that's an email from her special advisor, Abby Tibbs, in February, where the, and I'm paraphrasing, Tibbs says, Governor, we really don't have a plan on behavioral health, mental health, which is one of the governor's top three priorities. We all know that Oregon is among the worst states in the nation at delivering mental health services. So Tibbs says to the governor, you know, 14 months in, we still don't have a plan. We need you to focus on this. And, you know, what I'm hearing from people around the governor's office is that the First Lady, Amy Kotek Wilson, by inserting herself into staff meetings and planning and policy meetings around that topic, behavioral health, has really made it difficult for staff and for the Oregon Health Authority to, you know, make the aggressive improvements that we need in this state. So what I'm trying to get to in that story is that by putting her wife into this role, the governor has put her wife's interests ahead of the public's interest. And I think that is what this story is about.
Well, and the, you know, Amy Kotek Wilson claims some expertise, but she's basically was a low-level social worker who worked at Cascadia Behavioral Health. She marries the governor, you know, this marriage they've got, and then the governor decides to, and I'm trying to figure out whether her wife said, I want to be involved because I am mentally ill, I do have an addiction problem, so I'm the perfect person to help design this, or whether the governor just decided, I don't want to deal with this, but my wife knows about it, so I'm going to farm this out to somebody the voters never chose and don't pay a salary to, and she's not accountable to the voters. Do you have a sense of which one it is? Did she just try to farm out the job she didn't want to do to somebody who couldn't get it done either, or what?
My perception is that the governor, all things being equal, thinks this is a huge priority and really wants to make it better, make a very bad dysfunctional system better. My second perception is that Amy Kotek Wilson would really like to be involved, and that the governor has said, yes, you can be involved. And so that involvement, which she has green-lighted to a person who wasn't elected, who isn't accountable to anybody, who isn't, you know, in the chain of command like a staff employee would be, has created some chaos. And I think that's a decision that the governor made based on how her wife would like to be involved. I think that you can see that five very capable, very loyal members of the governor's staff have left that office. They haven't brought any new people in, so the office is, you know, operating at far less than capacity. Plus, and I think this is another really important point, staff raised these concerns for months and months and months. They raised them in all kinds of different ways. The governor had a clear choice to make. Do I listen to my staff? Do I please my wife? And she went with the wife. So what does that tell anybody else who might want to come and work there? What does it tell people, you know, inside and outside of government? It tells them that the governor's wife won, and that you'd be crazy to take a job there.
Yeah, I share that. And the other thing is, Nigel, as you point out, 14 months in, if Amy Kotek Wilson, because of her own personal knowledge of mental health and addiction, because of her training as a social worker, was the perfect person to do it, they'd have produced something after 14 months. But if the proof in the pudding is they haven't produced anything, it sounds like Amy, because a governor could go to her staff and say, I need a plan and I need it in 6 months. And the staff could say, we will do that or we can't do it in that amount of time, but she could demand results. She can't, perhaps she can't. I don't know the nature of their relationship beyond the fact that they're married, but maybe she can't go to her wife and say, you got to get this done, and I need it done now. You can do that with staff. You can't do that maybe with your wife, depending on the relationship. And the other thing that I've never heard anybody, and I think it's important, and you tell me if you disagree, Amy Kotek Wilson has said she has been mentally ill. We don't know if she currently is or not. She has been an addict. Apparently alcohol, but we don't know if she still is, an active alcoholic, whatever you call somebody who's still drinking, or whether this is in the past. But I've shared with my audience that every time I've met somebody who's a recovering alcoholic, they say, well, I've been clean and sober, 6 years, 10 months and 3 days. They'll tell you to the time. So should we assume that Amy Kotek Wilson is still an alcoholic and that that's part of the problem that the governor is trying to address by having the state babysit her wife? Or is this somebody who really is a recovering alcoholic who's been clean and sober for some period of time? And is it important that we know that or don't?
I don't have any information on that. I have asked about that. I don't know. I think regardless of the answer, the outcome is kind of the same, which is that the state is making, has a clear plan on education. It may not be working yet. It has a clear plan on housing. May not be working yet, but we know what the plan is. We know what the deliverables are. We know what we can expect. Not true on behavioral health. And so I just think regardless of the First Lady's personal situation, this is not the way you govern a state, and it's not the way you tackle a complex public health issue that is a disgrace in Oregon, that delivery of behavioral health services where we're consistently 49th or 50th. I mean, that's a disgrace, and you should be taking it very, very seriously and putting your absolute best, most qualified people in charge of it.
Yeah, and is there any indication that any of this is going to change anytime soon? Because it sounds like you would have to be crazy to go to work in that office right now.
Well, I know that there are a lot of people who are encouraging the governor to rethink the position that she has taken, which is the position that caused 5 staff people to leave. I know that. The governor is going to meet with the press at 3 o'clock today for only the second time since this story started, which was back on March 22nd. I don't know what she's going to say. I hope for the state of Oregonians that she may rethink her position. I don't know if she's going to do that or not.
Yeah, or maybe she'll do what Kitzhaber did. Nigel, thank you so much. I appreciate you coming to us on this important story.
Take care, Lars. See ya.
You can find the story at WWeek.com. That's Nigel Jacobs, the Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter for Willamette Week. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show. Work so you don't have to. Bringing the political heat. He's Lars Larson. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. I want to talk about that crazy transit project I mentioned to you a moment ago that's insanely expensive. But because we were just talking about graffiti criminal activity, Jason called in. And Jason, I understand you're with a company that actually has a graffiti tracker software. That sounds intriguing. Welcome to the program. Thanks for listening in Eugene on the Radio Northwest Network. Tell me about it.
Hi, Lars. Well, the program's called Graffiti Tracker, and it's a system where you will go out to graffiti, side of the wall, a bus, a window, scratched mirror in a bathroom, and you can take a picture of that image or whatever tag it could be, and the system will store that damage, if you will, and then it collaborates that with bunch of other graffiti that's out there. So it'll basically, it's like facial recognition. So yeah. Every time the perp goes and tags a wall, a dumpster, or wherever he could be, or she, when you go out and photograph that, it'll store it, and then it collects it so that it puts it in a database, shows you how many times that individual has been here, 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 or there, shows you a tracking pattern of their normal route, you know, like mice usually travel the wall, and it'll show you like a street map for where this individual goes. And law enforcement in California has been pretty successful with actually going to the front door of these individuals and saying, hey, you're responsible for about, let's look it up here, about $50,000 worth of damage to public and private property. When we pulled that together, tried to get it implemented here in Eugene, there was a law enforcement officer that he's recently left, but he was like the graffiti cop. And he would go out and spray lines through graffiti and, you know, do his own thing on his own time. And we did the same. But what's interesting is that they turned their head to it. They said there's not enough resources, there's not enough funding, there's not enough, you know, this is just graffiti is all it is. But the graffiti that we were taking pictures of was Kill Trump and a lot of the stuff
wow.
that I can't say on the air and BLM. There was one instance where I was actually confronted by law enforcement because someone called in and said that they're painting over a mural, and it wasn't a mural. It was during all the riots and whatever happened in town here. And it said Black Lives Matter across the side of a building. We have a gallon of gray paint and went ahead and started covering it up. And law enforcement said, what are you doing? That's not your wall. You have no right to be here. And
so
we were trying to
cover
up. So
in other words, law enforcement ignores the people who are doing damage to the building, and when you come to put plain gray paint over the damage, which to some extent repairs it, they say you don't have permission to be here like the graffiti vandals did?
Yep, they can be there, they can damage the wall, they can, you know, go outside the law and do what they want to do and destroy public property or private. But when someone tries to repair it, it's thrown in your face as this is, you are vandalizing now.
Now, how do you mind my asking, if you go to a law enforcement agency and you say, buy this software, put it out there and let your officers use it, and it could be, I mean, you could assign the software to a bunch of officers. They wouldn't all have to be the graffiti cop, and they could just say, whenever you see graffiti, snap a picture in a time and date and location. How expensive is it? Do you mind saying?
It's not that expensive for, you know, a government agency to purchase it, and any law enforcement, any officer could have it on their phone, on the ready, where they all have smartphones. You take a picture of it, it uploads to the database, it's right there, it geotags it so you know where you're at, and it's photographic evidence that hopefully will come back and, you know, get that individual that put it on the building. And part of my hope was that Eugene could take the sheriff's department, the road crew, and what you were saying earlier, have a graffiti cleanup crew and abatement service that they'd go out on a Saturday at 6 o'clock in the morning, rain or shine, and get out there and start scrubbing and or painting over. And they had no interest in it at all. And, you know, that's a problem where Eugene is not as bad as Portland as when you're driving up and going to Vancouver. It's just left side, right side, every square inch of
all the way
up properties. Yeah.
Believe me, my wife and I, we drive that path a lot. And every time I just know my wife's going to, she's going to say, and I say, it's, you know, I hate it too. I just don't know what they're going to do to get on top of it. And sadly, I mean, I looked it up because I wanted to make sure I wasn't overstating it. Any kind of graffiti vandalism is a misdemeanor, which is a crime for which jail's available, at least as a threat. If you do more than $1,000 damage, then it can be charged as a felony. So they certainly have the tools in hand. Now, am I saying divert people from rape and murder and other more serious crimes? No. But I think this is the kind of thing you could almost use in incremental time, you know, where an officer's out, he's not working on any calls, he snaps a few pictures, and maybe at some point they identify this is where this person is, and then you go tag him. You know, you tag them, And I'd yep. frankly like to tag him with a paintball gun, but, you know, that's a different matter. But tag him, charge him, and say, if you're looking at some jail time, are you willing to knock off his behavior? And if you get caught a second time, then we'll bring down the felony charges. You could get people's attention at the very least. I'll give you the last 10 seconds.
Well, Lars, great idea. And I think the community resource officers would be able to, you know, implement this and then have it at the ready. I mean, not every law enforcement officer is going to have the availability to, you know, hey, I'm watching graffiti today. We've got other things to do. But, you know, if graffiti tracker could be a method that's used.
Jason, we're going to get your contact information. I want to hang on to that. Thanks, Jason.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
The Lars Larson Show.
Quiet, please.
Ladies and gentlemen.
You ready for the big show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Look, if you hate cops just because of the cops, the next time you get in trouble, call a crackhead.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
I may be a white boy, but I'm not stupid.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
And then we're going to kick the Biden crime family out of the White House.
Here's your host.
My memory is so bad, I let you speak.
Lars Larson. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. You know, I hear a lot of lies in my line of work, and I hear those lies, but one of the ones that I've heard for the longest period of time is the one that says, without millions and millions of illegal aliens, why America's economy simply could not function. And we're hearing it from, among other places, a member of Congress, member of the Democrat Party, and that would be Val Hoyle, who has a lot of problems. I mean, she's got corruption problems, she's under investigation, but she also has an opponent who's willing to call that lie out, and that is Air Force veteran Monique Despain, who's running for the U.S. Congress in Oregon's 4th Congressional District to replace the corrupt Val Hoyle. Now, Monique may not call her corrupt, I will call her corrupt, but one of the things she's done recently is she went to the southern border of the United States. And like most Democrats, what she saw there was all of the necessary workers to keep America running. And she literally told people that an open border is necessary and that illegal aliens are needed in America. Let me ask Monique Despain, what should we make of that, Monique?
Well, our Oregon congresswoman is distinguishing herself in the national news now for this outrageous, I would say, dangerous position that she insists on foisting on the Oregonians, literally saying that we need this movement through the border. She was down in El Paso, Texas in February and just gushing with how operations were going smoothly, processing hundreds and hundreds of people a day, when a month later, the Texas National Guard was attacked by those very immigrants. I guess just mowing down the Texas National Guard to get to the jobs that Val Hoyle wants to offer in Oregon.
By the way, I'm talking to Monique Despain, who's running for Congress. Tell people where to find you on the web, on social media, so they can help your campaign.
MoniqueForCongress.com.
Thanks. Now, one of the things I want to push back on, could I talk you into this, Monique? Could we stop calling them immigrants? And let me tell you why. There are immigrants to America, more than a million a year, who come in legally. It's very tough. It's expensive. It's time consuming. It often takes years to come here legally. And I call those people immigrants, which America does need. To mix them up with people who've just come across the border illegally, unverified, unvetted, everything else, and not intending to abide by our laws. To call them both by the same name is like calling a pharmacist and a crack dealer as both members of the pharmaceutical trade. You know, you say, I think it's insulting to real immigrants to describe any of these illegal alien border hoppers as immigrants. Can we agree on that?
Absolutely. I talk to legal immigrants every week who are offended, just as you say. Well, FBI Director Chris Wray, he's calling them dangerous individuals coming across our southern border. He's calling them criminals. He's calling them members of ISIS. He's calling them a national threat. So, yeah, I think we should be calling them something different than immigrants.
Okay, fair enough. Now, what do we do about this? Is Val Hoyle going to be willing to debate you on these issues? Because I can't imagine how she's going to defend the idea that she has said it's on a YouTube video of her in which she says, I get out to the most conservative parts of my district and I humanize and bring this issue right down to what matters. In other words, she's happy to go to parts of the state of Oregon that she represents as a member of Congress and explain to them why illegal aliens are going to come in, and she wants them to come in to take the jobs of some of her constituents.
She literally says that part of her job as a congresswoman is to get out among the conservative part of her district, which, by the way, is the bulk of the district. Congressional District 4 is conservative in large part, and that her job is to break through the disinformation and misinformation about the border crisis. And like I said, FBI Director Chris Wray is testifying regularly that we are in a, that he calls it a threat that has reached a whole other level, he says. But our congresswoman ignores that, and she's going to school conservatives when they say to her, quote, why don't you just shut down the border? And she says, well, I need to point out that we need this movement, that we need the workforce. And I will ask her in debates that I look forward to, when she says that this open flow has to happen, why isn't she putting some energy into developing the workforce in Oregon? How are we going to address the housing crisis when we have American citizens that do have full-time jobs that can't afford housing? Where is she going to house her illegal immigrants and criminals that I just said? There's a whole category of people that she would like to welcome to Oregon.
And by the way, Monique, she's a member of a lawmaking body. That's what the Congress does. So there are laws that say this is the way to come into the United States illegally. These are all the ways you would come in illegally. If she thinks the laws are wrong, then change them. Except at this point, nobody in Congress, or not nobody, but not a majority of Congress, believe we should change the laws and make people who simply walk into the United States legal residents of the country. And if that's what she believes should be done, propose the bill and see how far it gets.
She's promoting the Dignity Act. Have you heard of that? It basically codifies.
Describe it for the audience, if you would, Monique.
Well, it basically codifies everything that's happening now. And pays for it and has to send millions, billions of dollars to the border to fund NGOs that will process people in an orderly way. So basically imagine it just continues to be as it is now, but it's legalized and it's a lot easier to get resources to these illegal immigrants. It's the Dignity Act, and that's what she and her Democrat colleagues were promoting when they met in El Paso. And she made these remarks.
Can you imagine the cost? I mean, Denver, Colorado, for instance, figures it has 40,000 illegals there right now. And they figure they have already spent $170 million serving the needs of these illegals who aren't even supposed to be there. And they're telling their own residents, by the way, we're going to have to cut back police services, park services, community services, and education because we have to pay the cost of all these people. I can't wait for Americans to stand up and say, don't you give those people one more dime. You take care of our needs first, and their needs can be taken care of when they come back legally. Because I think Americans are going to hit a boiling point and say, you're taking things from us, and they're doing it in New York and Chicago and everywhere else. Go ahead.
Yeah. No, it's unsustainable. It was a year ago, at least, I think, that I heard the mayor of New York saying it was costing New York $800 million a month. And that was, like I say, almost a year ago that he stated that. He's a very liberal mayor. He said, we're going to lose our city. And that's happening. It's happening in Oregon. And at the same time that Congresswoman Val Hoyle wants to increase the restrictions on accessing our natural resources, which are the major source of revenue for these our communities in CD4, for law enforcement, for education, at the same time she's reducing access to those resources, she wants to increase the need by welcoming hundreds and thousands of illegal immigrants.
Absolutely right. That's Monique Despain, Monique for Congress. That's Monique Despain, who's running for the Congress against the very corrupt Democrat Val Hoyle, who's in the 4th District now.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
small town politics with big town opinions. This is the Lars Larson Show. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Tuesday. Always glad to get to your calls. I mentioned to you, as the Daily Grill suggested by journalist Jonathan Cho at the Discovery Institute, that we've now got another bunch of illegal aliens in Seattle's Central District. And I guess they figured that if we used extortion before and got what we wanted, I think the last time they occupied either a school grounds or a park and they demanded more money for their hotel bill and they got it. So they figure, well, if it worked once, it can work again. I don't know if Jonathan Cho shares that conclusion, but I'm glad to welcome him back to the show. How are you, Jay Cho? How's things going?
Surprised but not surprised that we're dealing with another situation like this again. More than 100 illegal immigrants. By the way, the same group that tried to extort the city and county the last time for funds, back at it, now at a different park. Late Monday afternoon, they essentially decided to set up dozens of tents at Powell Barnett Park. This is a historic black neighborhood in Seattle's Central District, just minutes from downtown. The neighbors had no idea what was going on. Many of them woke up and saw my video this morning and then looked outside their doors and were just shocked. I reached out to Councilmember Joy Hollingsworth, who represents the area. She's closely monitoring the situation. But look, bottom line, how about some enforcement, right?
Yeah. Well, in fact, Joy Hollingsworth and Bruce Harrell, the mayor, have both said, look, we don't have any cash for this kind of thing. So the extortionists have run the victims out of cash. And did these two not understand that if you pay off the extortionist once, that will not be the last time you're going to have to pay off the extortionist, because that's how extortion works?
It's these politicians, these elected officials, they are trying to appease the migrants here, these asylum seekers, and they think you give them an inch, you know, they won't take a mile. Well, guess what? That's happening right now, and there's no end in sight. In fact, what else is happening right now is I have people on the ground who work with the migrants very closely right now and others in the area. And there are many illegal immigrants here. They're being advised now to set up shop in this park, hoping for resources if that comes.
Okay, so tell me this. As I understand, unless they've been given, and the Biden administration has handed out a certain number of work permits, but the vast majority of the people who've entered the country illegally have been given an appearance date, a ticket, basically, by Customs and Border Protection, but they're arriving in cities. I'm not saying this to draw sympathy to them, but they're arriving with no legal authority to work any job whatsoever. So they are going to be 100% dependent on the city. Does the city of Seattle understand that? That all of the illegal aliens in the city are either going to have to steal what they need just to fulfill their needs, or you're going to have to give them the money, one way or the other, as long as they're here until they're told to leave?
Well, they're going to be getting some money. The state recently released a few million dollars for these illegal immigrants. They're not going to see any of that until potentially mid to late summer. So in the meantime, you hear stories of some of these migrants working odd jobs. And look, I'm not implying that they're all criminals, but, you know, you're also hearing stories of theft coming from these groups just to kind of stay afloat. And what's also maddening to a lot of the Americans on the streets, living on the streets homeless, is that the migrants are, many of them are driving vehicles right now. They've been given driver's licenses. They've been given stipends to survive. And let me be very clear. This group of about 100 plus was originally staying at Riverton Park United Methodist Church in Tukwila. But during the cold snap earlier this year, around this, you know, around January, they demanded they go into the motels. But the pastor at the church said, hey, I can't guarantee you what happens after that. So she gave these migrants money to stay in the motels. And ever since, they've been trying to figure out what to do next. And right now, protest and setting up in this park is the next best option.
Well, and Jonathan, I guess I don't see anybody on the Seattle City Council who are objecting, and they should be. or among the general public, other than you as a journalist doing it. But when I saw in Denver, where Denver's looking at 40,000 illegals in its city, and that's the estimate, a woman stepped up to the, you know, city council lectern to testify as a member of the public and said, look, if you got to spend $1,000, just $1,000 a month to house, feed, clothe, and care for each one of these 40,000 people, that's $40 million a month. That's $500 million a year. So the fact that the legislature or the state government has freed up a few, I mean, what sounds like a lot of money, millions of dollars, even tens of millions, that's going to evaporate quickly, isn't it?
Yeah, you hit it right on the head. Lars, this is a Band-Aid. This is a temporary fix. You were talking about the asylum hearings. Yeah, they're here right now waiting in line. But some of these asylum hearing court dates won't be happening at least for the next 2, 3, maybe even 4 years.
Yep.
So they're here right now draining resources. Their kids have to go to public schools. The 911 calls to many of these migrant camps are off the charts. And they're all being paid for by taxpayer dollars.
And the number I always have to mention, Jonathan, because I've checked it again and again, what percentage of asylum seekers get a yes from the federal courts? And the answer is at most 15%. The other 85% are told you don't qualify. You're not fleeing persecution, and under federal law, you don't qualify. So we're seeing cities that are draining resources away from legitimate needs of actual citizens and paying the money to support the existence of people, the vast majority of whom are going to be told in 2 or 3 years, you can't be here anyway, you have to leave. So we're draining all this money out, all these resources, and in some cities, I don't know if Seattle's hit this yet, but as you point out, the 911 calls are off the charts, the cities are already short of police and other resources, and then you say, and we're going to drain a bunch of money. You know, when they say we're going to suck all this money out, it's got to come from somewhere. Does it come from police? Does it come from fire? Does it come from medical? Does it come from parks? Does it come from school? It's got to come from somewhere, doesn't it?
Yeah, and I think really what's becoming more evident now than ever as the weeks and months go by for many of the neighbors in this region, you know, initially they were sympathetic, they wanted to help, but many of these migrants are starting to develop this attitude of entitlement. Again, being a part of these protests, demanding resources, demanding money, demanding certain conditions instead of what's being offered. Again, many of these people were staying at Riverton Park United Methodist Church, but the conditions there weren't good enough, so they decided to venture off on their own, and this is what's happening.
And they go to a hotel, and somebody pays their bill for a while, and when the money stops, they go out and stage one of these so-called protests or occupations, and of course it leaves the police in a spot where, what do? Arrest these people and put them where? Or write them tickets, which they're free to ignore because their status in the country is already illegal. What do they care about a ticket? You know, it doesn't mean anything to them. Anything else that's significant about what is happening? And are there other groups that are watching this example and saying, well, why don't we do the same thing?
Yeah, there are, because this particular group, they've been getting away with making these demands because some of these lawmakers are caving. So there are other groups right now that are kind of sitting tight, seeing where things shake out, are now realizing, wait, we can make a move as well. So it's really turning into this hot mess, and it's really becoming a free-for-all right now, Lars.
Jonathan, we appreciate your reporting. Thanks for the work you do with the Discovery Institute, and I appreciate your time today.
All right. Thank you, Lars.
That is Jonathan Cho. You can follow him on social media, J Cho on X. And, of course, you can hear him here on this show as well. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show. The Lars Larson Show. Unwrapping the news so you don't have to.
Back to the Lars Larson Show. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I think most of you who listen to this show know my point of view on government subsidies on anything. I think it's almost always a bad idea. I have a tough time even coming up with an example where I think a government subsidy was a good idea. And then when you say, what if the government gets involved in creating housing? And not just housing, but affordable housing. And at that point, my antenna go up and I say, that seems like a tremendously bad idea, something sure to be done inefficiently, ineffectively, and very expensively by the government. So I thought I'd talk to Randall O'Toole about that. He is both a land use and transportation policy analyst, and he's also director of the Thoreau Institute. He works with several think tanks, and he's the author of several books, including, most notably, American Nightmare, How the Government Undermines the Dream of Home Ownership. Randall, welcome back.
Hey, Lars. Glad to be back.
Hey, when we see that in almost every part of America, there's a shortage of housing, and the government bemoans this and says, something has to be done about this, and then the government usually immediately says, and we're just the folks to do it. How is that likely to work out when the government is spending literally tens of billions of dollars a year, in theory, to create housing that is affordable for Americans to buy or rent?
Well, it turns out it doesn't work out at all. First of all, the housing that government builds ends up costing a lot more than housing that private parties would build. The government just spends way too much. And second of all, for every 5 housing units built by the government, 4 fewer market rate units are built, which means they aren't really adding that much to the supply of housing.
And in fact, that's what is that? The economists call that substitute goods. That if you say, well, the government's going to build that housing, well, then there's no incentive for the private sector to get in there and do it as well.
That's right. And the government has been subsidizing, the federal government has been subsidizing housing on a large scale since 1949. And many of the developments that were built were high rises that proved to be unlivable. And almost all of them outside of New York City have since been demolished. Some of them as soon as 17 years after they were built because nobody wanted to live in them. So in about 1986, somebody in Congress got the idea, and remember this was a Republican Congress at the time, let's let the private sector build affordable housing instead of the government. So they created a system of grants to private companies that would build housing and then promise to rent that housing to low-income people at below market rates for 30 years. And since then, they've been spending as much as $10 billion a year on this program and building more and more units, except 30 years has gone by. So now, like in 2019, more units lapsed, you know, past the 30-year period after which they didn't have to rent it at below market prices than were actually built. So we're actually seeing a reduction in the supply.
And that means that when they lapse, they go back into the private sector at whatever the market rent is. And I would imagine rents go up dramatically. Am I right?
Sometimes the owners decide, you know, sometimes the owners are nonprofits and they decide to keep renting them at below market prices. But sometimes the owners decide to raise the rents, and the rents have been known to double or more as soon as the 30 years are up.
And why is it, I mean, I've given my audience examples of private sector builders who are building units, apartment units or other units in the same neighborhoods for the same clientele, but oftentimes at dramatically less money per square foot to build them. Why is government housing, subsidized housing, so expensive when the private sector provides a perfect model of how to do it inexpensively? Is there any way to understand why it's more expensive when from government?
A big reason for that is that a lot of cities and states have decided that low-income people should be housed in what are called transit-oriented developments. I'm sure you've heard this term before. It's basically four to six story buildings, usually, sometimes high rises, and they're located along transit lines. And the idea is that low income people can't afford cars, so we'll locate them near transit and they'll be able to get to work. The only problem being that 90% of low income people have cars, And of the ones that don't, most of them still drive alone to work in cars provided by their employers. So it's not like they're short on transportation. But the problem is that these mid-rise and high-rise buildings cost a lot more to build per square foot than low-rise buildings. So when the government started to subsidize developers building housing back in the 80s, most of the developments that were built were like two-story apartment buildings.
Yeah.
I'm sure you're familiar with them. You know, they all have outside entrances. You might add a stairway to an outside balcony that has an entrance to the upstairs apartments. But there is no enclosed shared areas. All the shared areas are outside, which means there's no need to have a common heating systems and common insulation and carpeting and things like that. Well, now the housing that's being built are these four- and five-story buildings. They have to have large hallways. They have to have elevators. They have to use a lot of steel and concrete to build them. And they have big lobbies. And all of these things increase the cost so that instead of building, you know, a 20,000-square-foot building that's all livable, they build a 20,000-square-foot building, and about 40% of it is shared common areas, which means only 60% of it is livable. And that means the cost per square foot of the livable area has gone way up. So between 2004 and 2019, the amount of money being spent on affordable housing doubled, and the number of units declined, because so many cities have shifted from two low-rise housing to mid-rise and high-rise housing, and the cost have gone up per housing unit by 130%.
Let me ask you about one other issue, and that is if you encourage people to live in these TODs, the transit-oriented developments, where they're going to assume you don't have a car and you don't have the ability to put a car anywhere, then if you don't have a car, doesn't that cut you out of a lot of economic opportunities? Somebody comes along and says, hey, I've got a great job for you. And you say, where is it? You say, well, it's 5 miles over there. Well, if the bus doesn't run there, I can't take the job, even if it's a great job. And I can't buy a car because I have no place to put it.
Absolutely. And in Portland and in many other urban areas, you can reach twice as many jobs in a 20-minute auto drive as in a 60-minute transit ride. And you typically can reach 30 times as many jobs in a 20-minute auto drive as a 60-minute transit ride. So you have access to more jobs, you have access to better housing, you have access to lower-cost consumer goods. You know, you can go to supermarkets that are further away than walking distance from your home. And all of those things are an improvement if you have a car. So they build these apartment complexes with limited parking, which means they don't expect people to have cars. And they're on a transit line, but that gives them limited access to jobs. They're keeping them poor is what's happening.
Yeah, that's what it said. That's what I was trying to get to is you've locked people into this. Plus, they've got the incentive that this is subsidized. Anything you rent or buy outside of this is not subsidized or is less likely to be subsidized. So if you want to make that jump, you say, well, I can take the better job, but then I have to afford a car. I'll probably not qualify for my subsidized apartment anymore. That means I'll have to pay more for rent. So unless the job pays a lot more money, you're going to actually have fewer opportunities rather than more opportunities. That's Randall O'Toole, who's a land use and transportation policy analyst. Randall, thank you very much. His latest book is called American Nightmare, How Government Undermines the Dream of Home Ownership.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show. Literally have Lars with you all day, every day. Podcasts at Spotify, Apple, SoundCloud, and live right now. What a time to be alive. Here's Lars.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show on this Wednesday and the Radio Northwest Network, serving the region with honestly provocative talk on a daily basis. This segment of the show is brought to you by the home power generating folks at ProTech Power. Make sure your loved ones are safe when the power goes out. And as we know, over the last few weeks, the power does go out from time to time. Call 541-ONAGEN. That's 541-ONAGEN. Let's go to our first, well, second naysayer of the day. Daniel, welcome to the program. If you listen, you know how much we love naysayers. What do you and I disagree about that makes you a naysayer?
Well, you might be able to clear it up pretty quick, but
okay.
With the food in the public school system, isn't that food already paid for by the taxpayers?
No, because if they decide to go from lunch, which most people, kids, pay a portion of the lunch, and there's a small subsidy for most kids, and then for some kids that are thought to be low income because their parents are on public assistance, they may get qualified for the free lunch program. What this bill imagines doing, and it's an idiotic idea, is that every single kid going to public school would get a, quote, free lunch paid for by the taxpayers. So you go from a lunch program that's partially paid for from the federal government to a program that serves breakfast, lunch, and often dinner as well at no direct cost to the student or the family, all costs paid for by the taxpayer. The difference is pretty gigantic.
Okay, so as it stands right now, it's partially funded by the taxpayer and partially funded by parents.
Yeah, by parents or the kids. The kids go to school and they say, Mom, I need lunch money, and it's a couple of bucks, and the actual cost of making the lunch is a little bit more than that. So there's some public subsidy in every single lunch. So you've got a little bit of socialism going on, and what the Democrats in Washington want out of this bill they've introduced in the legislature is they want full-blown socialism where your child grows up understanding from school age 5 to 18 that breakfast, lunch, and dinner are not provided by mom and dad, they're provided by the government. Do you think that's a good idea?
I would have to say that is not a good idea because, you know, kids should learn that their parents are, you know, the breadwinners, and they should be able to provide them with meals, obviously. Agreed. I mean, it's great that the school, in some senses, can provide those to kids that might need it, but I don't know. You kind of gave me a good gist of things there. So
here's the thing, Daniel. Anything that gets between parents and their kids, I'm against. I think parents have a right and a responsibility. So it's two sides of that. They have the right to guide their kids in growing up. They also have a responsibility to do that. And when the government steps in and says, no, we'll do it for you, you get to encourage people to be lazy parents. I know that most of the parents I know are as hardworking as the day is long. But some of them would say, yeah, if the government will provide my kids medical care, make decisions about things like transgender, birth control, having sex and all that, fine, let the government do it. I think it's terrible for America, but thank you for the call. Let's go to Christopher. Hey, Christopher, welcome to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Christopher, what's on your mind?
No, I just had a question just about funding for education for students. My understanding is that there should be, the law is that there'd be government funding for first through 12th grades. But does that necessarily mean, and your screener before said something about school choice, does that necessarily mean that the monies only go to government or public schools?
Not at all. And in fact, in Oregon and Washington, the majority of kids go to public schools. But in many states, you can choose to take the dollars that follow your child and take them to a parochial school, a religious school, a charter school, an online school, any of those. And Christopher, that actually matches up with most other programs. Do you know any people who are on food stamps?
No, not right offhand.
But you know about food stamps, right?
Yeah, they don't have any government stores quite
no.
yet.
And how about this? If an older member of your family is on Medicare, when they go for medical care, do they have to go to a government hospital?
Absolutely not. As a matter of fact,
Do you think we'd all be better off if everybody who was on Medicare had to go to a government-run hospital, say one that was run as efficiently as the VA?
Oh, you're going to get me started on a rant.
Let's not do that. Save that for First Amendment Friday. Thanks for the call. Let's go to Thea. Hey, Thea, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. We got about a minute before the break.
Hi, I'm just calling just to inform that some districts already have 100% being paid by the district or taxpayers, because from what I worked at, I'm retired now, but just recently, the district had all students were paid for.
Is that a good thing?
And for lunch.
Is that a good thing?
100% no. Because they throw it away.
Yep.
I mean, if you look at the percentage of food that's thrown away, it's probably 80% or higher.
If your grandson had lunch at your house today, would you let him throw his food away?
Oh, no, because he'd eat what was made.
Absolutely right. Thea, thanks for the call. You got the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show. The Lars Larson Show.